KSDP, 8:30 a.m. in Sandpoint, K201DA, 88.1.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
We stand ready to continue our work together to deliver on the one big beautiful bill, as President Trump named it himself.
Nobody on the Republican side pushing this bill wants to have an in-person town hall and look their constituents in the face and explain to them why they want to hand Elon Musk another $25 billion contract while jacking up your health insurance costs, not just by hundreds, but by thousands of dollars.
House Republicans passed Trump's sweeping budget legislation with massive tax breaks for the rich, while slashing spending for Medicaid, Medicare, food assistance, clean energy, and more. The bill includes the single biggest increase in funding for immigration enforcement in U.S. history. We'll speak with the nation's Chris Layman. His article, Trump and Johnson's Big Ugly Lie. Then detained Palestinian activist Mahmoud Khalil testifies at his asylum hearing. His deportation could result in assassination, kidnapping, torture. Hours before Thursday's hearing, Khalil was allowed to meet and hold his one-month-old son for the first time. We'll get an update from his lawyer, Ramzi Qasem.
Mahmoud has still found ways to speak out in support of Palestinian lives and dignity. And there are many people who have come out in his support, in support of the Palestinian people, showing that they are undeterred, that they're unbound, and that they're unafraid.
And this Sunday marks 5 years since police murdered George Floyd. The video shocked the world and spurred a global movement for racial justice. As he lay dying, Floyd gasped for air repeatedly. "I can't breathe," he said.
We know that George Floyd was unjustly killed by Minneapolis police officers. The video has gone viral. People are outraged. This is yet another reminder that the Minneapolis Police Department has a culture of violence, specifically when it comes to their interactions with the African-American community.
This comes as Trump's Justice Department has just dismissed police reform and oversight agreements in Minneapolis and Louisville. We'll go to Minneapolis. And finally, historian Jean Theo Harris on her new book, King of the North, about Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King's own experiences with police brutality and his organizing against it in Los Angeles, Chicago, and New York that has gotten largely overlooked. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In northern Gaza, more than 50 Palestinians were killed or are presumed dead following an Israeli airstrike that leveled a four-story home in Jabalia. Civil defense workers described a horrific scene, with rescue operations severely hampered due to a lack of heavy machinery. The attack came as Gaza officials said at least 29 children and seniors starved to death over the past 2 days amidst a worsening hunger crisis brought on by Israel's near-total blockade. On Thursday, there were chaotic scenes as crowds scrambled to receive the first freshly baked bread in weeks from a handful of bakeries in south and central Gaza. Israel's army said it granted access Thursday to 107 humanitarian aid trucks carrying limited supplies of food, medical equipment, and pharmaceuticals. Aid groups say at least 500 aid trucks are needed every day for 2 months to alleviate Gaza's hunger crisis. This is UN spokesperson Stefan Dujarric.
The shipment from yesterday is limited in quantity and nowhere near sufficient to meet the scale and scope of Gaza's 2.1 million.
Lebanese Prime Minister Nawaf Salam has condemned a series of Israeli attacks across southern Lebanon and the eastern Bekaa Valley. Israel's military said a drone strike killed a Hezbollah operative late Thursday, part of what Lebanese officials described as Israel's heaviest attack since reaching a ceasefire agreement with Hezbollah in November, which Israel has repeatedly violated. In Jerusalem, a member of the Arab-Jewish Hadash Party was forcefully removed from the podium of Israel's Knesset Thursday as he condemned Israel's assault on Gaza. This is the lawmaker, Ayman Odeh.
After a year and a half of war in which you killed 19,000 children, 53,000 residents of Gaza, you destroyed all the universities and the hospitals, and for you there is no political win. You feel there is no political win. That's why you go crazy.
The Trump administration Thursday barred Harvard University from enrolling international students by revoking its student exchange and visitor program certification. The news sent shockwaves through Harvard and beyond, with legal experts warning the move is likely illegal. Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem cited anti-Semitism for the move, an accusation the Trump administration's also wielded against other universities when withdrawing federal funds. Noem also accused Harvard of, quote, coordinating with the Chinese Communist Party, unquote. In April, Harvard refused to abide by Trump's list of demands related to DEI and free speech on campus. Harvard also challenged a Trump administration order to hand over the records of its current international students. Over a quarter of Harvard's student body is international. Unless courts block the Trump administration's order, current students would have to transfer out of Harvard or lose their visas. Mahmoud Khalil, the Columbia University graduate abducted by ICE, testified in court Thursday that he faces possible assassination, kidnapping, or torture if he were to be deported after being, quote, mislabeled a terrorist sympathizer by the U.S. government. Khalil has been locked up in an immigration prison in Jena, Louisiana, for over 2 months after he was taken from his New York home in March. Just hours before his testimony Thursday, Mahmoud Khalil was permitted to hold his one-month-old baby, Dean, for the first time since he was born. Hundreds of people rallied in Jena Thursday to demand justice for Khalil. Amy Greer, one of his lawyers, spoke to reporters after the court hearing.
As long as this genocide is unfolding and the ethnic cleansing happening in the West Bank continues to unfold to the silence of the Western part of the world, he will keep speaking. And this administration can keep throwing people away, keep trying to silence our communities, but we see what's happening, Mahmoud sees what's happening, and he is willing to exercise his voice and protect all of our rights.
We'll have more on this story later in the broadcast with another member of Mahmoud Khalil's legal team, Ramzi Qasem. Here in New York, alumni from Columbia and Barnard ripped up and burned their diplomas outside their alma mater Wednesday to protest the repression of free speech and persecution of pro-Palestinian student protesters on campus. This is Jeannie Dubnow, a Barnard graduate from the class of 1960.
My parents came here to escape the fascism in Nazi Germany.
My parents came here to escape the fascism in Nazi Germany.
And now I'm finding that we are facing fascism here.
And now I'm finding that we are facing fascism here in the United States.
And Columbia University is opening its arms to this fascist government.
In related news, students and staff at the University of Oregon have joined hunger strikers across the country demanding their school divest from Israel and protect free speech on campus. Hunger strikes are also ongoing at Yale, Stanford, and at California State University schools. Elsewhere in New York, a coalition of military veterans and other rights activists have begun a 40-day fast for Gaza. The hunger strikers are gathering at the U.S. mission to the U.N. for their action. They spoke in front of the U.N. Thursday as they launched their fast. This is 74-year-old Mike Ferner, former National Director of Veterans for Peace.
Our demands are full humanitarian aid under the authority of the United Nations. No more weapons to Israel, to stop the genocide, stop the killing, and start treating this earth as though it were sacred.
The Senate has voted to block California's landmark law phasing out gasoline-powered cars by 2035 in a bid to combat air pollution and the climate crisis. The vote was 51-44, with Democratic Senator Alyssa Slotkin of Michigan joining Republicans who used a procedural maneuver to avoid the Senate's filibuster rules, a process Democrats described as a nuclear option. California Governor Gavin Newsom called it a, quote, unconstitutional attack on California. and said the state would sue in federal court to block the federal mandate. 11 other states were set to follow California's lead with similar phase-outs of fossil fuel vehicles, accounting for 40% of the U.S. auto market. In more climate news, a new study from University of Maryland researchers finds the world's forests were destroyed at the fastest rate ever recorded last year, with an area the size of Italy lost to fires, as well as agriculture, logging, and mining. The Supreme Court has granted an emergency request by the Trump administration allowing the president to fire leaders of most independent government agencies. The Supreme Court's 6-3 ruling clears the way for Trump to terminate National Labor Relations Board member Gwynne Wilcox, as well as Kathy Harris, a member of the Merit Systems Protection Board, which protects the rights of federal workers. The ruling includes a narrow carve-out protecting the independence of the Federal Reserve. Earlier this month, Trump rattled markets when he mocked Fed Chair Jerome Powell as a fool and a major loser, asserting that he had the power to terminate him. This comes after a split three-judge panel at the U.S. Court of Appeals for Washington, D.C., cleared the way for President Trump's executive order stripping federal workers of their collective bargaining rights. The Center for American Progress reports the order affects 4 out of 5 federal workers represented by unions at more than a dozen federal agencies, more than 1 million people. The Supreme Court's narrowly rejected Oklahoma's bid to use federal funds to pay for what would have been the first religious charter school. Justice Amy Coney Barrett recused herself from Thursday's ruling, leaving the court deadlocked in a 4-4 decision, leaving intact an Oklahoma Supreme Court ruling that the proposed Catholic charter school violated the constitutional separation of church and state. Protesters gathered outside President Trump's Virginia Golf Club Thursday evening as he hosted a private dinner for 220 top spenders on his Trump meme coin. Altogether, the dinner attendees spent close to $400 million combined to gain access to Trump, many of them foreign nationals. Among the attendees were Justin Sun, a Chinese-born crypto billionaire, and Korean crypto executive Sungrak Oh. Massachusetts Democratic Senator Elizabeth Warren called the gathering an orgy of corruption. Oregon Democrat Jeff Merkley joined protesters outside Trump's golf club.
This is like the Mount Everest of corruption. Now, our founders were very worried about people buying influence with our corruption because they knew you can't have we the people government if it's government's being sold to others.
Federal prosecutors in Washington, D.C. have filed murder charges against the Chicago man accused of fatally shooting 2 Israeli embassy staff members outside the Capitol Jewish Museum Wednesday evening. Elias Rodriguez made an appearance in federal court Thursday afternoon. He may also face hate crime and terrorism charges and could face the death penalty if convicted. Russia and Ukraine exchanged heavy volleys of attack drones overnight, with Ukraine's Air Force saying it downed 112 of 128 incoming Russian drones, while officials in Moscow grounded planes at several major airports amidst attacks from Ukrainian UAVs. Elsewhere, Russian officials said a Ukrainian strike injured 12 people in Russia's Kursk region. This comes as Germany announced it has stationed a heavy combat unit of 4,800 soldiers in Lithuania, the first permanent deployment of German troops abroad since the Second World War. Chancellor Friedrich Merz said during a ceremony in Vilnius on Thursday, the troops would help protect NATO's eastern flank.
We know that security doesn't begin at our borders. It begins where our allies and partners have to defend it. That's why Lithuania's security is also our security.
Lithuania is a former Soviet republic that borders Russia's Kaliningrad, as well as Russian ally Belarus that joined NATO in 2004. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We begin today's show looking at Trump's sweeping budget bill that includes what's been described as the biggest Medicaid cuts in U.S. history. On early Thursday morning, House Republicans passed the bill giving massive tax breaks to the rich while slashing spending for Medicaid, Medicare, food assistance, and subsidies for clean energy. The measure just eked through, with a 215 to 214 vote that came after an all-night session and days of negotiations. The legislation would trigger $625 billion in Medicaid cuts over the next 10 years, denying coverage to an estimated 7.6 million Americans, according to the Congressional Budget Office. Food assistance under the federal SNAP program would also see $300 billion in cuts while adding billions in funding for Trump's border enforcement and mass deportation agenda. House Speaker Mike Johnson praised the budget package, speaking after the vote.
We look forward to the Senate's timely consideration of this once-in-a-generation legislation. We stand ready to continue our work together to deliver on the one big, beautiful bill, as President Trump named it himself.
Ahead of the House vote, Democratic Congressmember Greg Kassar of Texas confronted Republicans on the House Budget Committee on rising health care premiums for their constituents while giving billionaires more tax breaks.
In this bill, they're going to jack up the premiums on health care for the people that rely on the marketplace for their health care. And so I will hand the mic over, yield my time to any of my Republican colleagues that want to address the amount of money that their tax-paying citizens are going to have to pay in increased premiums for their health care. And what bothers me the most is that we want to hide it. Nobody wants here to talk about the fact that they're jacking up insurance costs on their own constituents while giving a billionaire a tax break. Nobody on the Republican side pushing this bill wants to have an in-person town hall and look their constituents in the face and explain to them why they want to hand Elon Musk another $25 billion contract while jacking up your health insurance costs, not just by hundreds, but by thousands of dollars.
Again, they're the largest Medicaid cuts in U.S. history. The legislation would trigger $625 billion in Medicare cuts over the next 10 years. Some Senate Republicans have voiced some concerns over the measure and will now have to pass their own version of the budget. With all Democratic senators opposed to the package, Republicans could resort to using the reconciliation process to avoid a filibuster. For more, we go to Washington, D.C. We're joined by Chris Layman, D.C. Bureau Chief of the Nation. His latest piece is headlined Trump and Johnson's Big Ugly Lie. Chris Layman, welcome back to Democracy Now! Lay out what's in the legislation.
Thanks, Amy. Always a pleasure. I would say the legislation is basically a mugging conducted by the 1% against the rest of us. It represents the single largest upward redistribution of wealth effectuated by any piece of legislation in our history. The tax cuts work out to about $4 trillion, and the chief beneficiaries are at the upper end of the income spectrum, people earning $4 million or more, the 0.1%, will realize $389,000 gains in their after-tax income, whereas the lowest quintile of earners who make $17,000 or less will be on the hook for $1,000 and some change in their after-tax income, and that number will rise over the 10-year course of this package. And the GOP has dishonestly peddled it as a necessary the cuts in the legislation as necessary fiscal discipline. In point of fact, this package will increase the federal deficit by $3 trillion. And you saw instantly the bond markets swooned on the news that this legislation has passed. The futures markets today are sort of in free fall. So it is just an outlandish piece of legislation, based on basic economic principles. And it is a massive giveaway to the wealthy. You mentioned, the historic cuts to Medicaid, to SNAP, to food assistance. There's also just, crass and corrupt lobbying giveaways. There's a provision in it that prohibits all states from regulating artificial intelligence. It's a staggering work of theft from on high.
And explain the on high. Explain what the billionaires get in exchange for cutting Medicaid, triggering the Medicare cuts, cutting clean energy, cutting food assistance.
They get $2.5 trillion in tax cuts. And that is, that's been the social contract, you know, behind the MAGA takeover of the GOP all this time. You know, the billionaires are more than happy to have Trump foment, you know, racial hatreds, you know, panic about the border, about DEI, what have you, go after universities, as we're now seeing, all in exchange for this, for yet more obscene wealth that, in, you know, as is crafted in this bill, is directly taking, you know, critically needed support and, you know, assistance from the middle class and the working class.
I want to ask you about the position of the Democratic Party in this. The party's faced widespread criticism, accused of failing to properly challenge Trump's agenda. There's a new piece by the new in the New Republic that says, quote, House Republicans managed to pass their draconian budget bill, which promises to make massive cuts to Medicaid, Medicare, food assistance early Thursday morning by a narrow one-vote margin that was only possible due to the deaths of three Democrats in this current Congress. It goes on to talk about on Wednesday, Representative Jerry Conley of Massachusetts passed away after battling esophageal cancer. He's the third Democrat to die in office this year and the sixth in just over a year. In March, longtime Arizona Congressmember Raul Grijalva passed away also after battling cancer. And Congressmember Sylvester Turner of Houston, Texas, died 6 days earlier. Can you talk about all of this?
Yes, this is, you know, an ongoing problem, and obviously this is all in the shadow of new revelations about how, you know, the Biden White House basically concealed the actual cognitive decline of the president. You know, there is a huge gerontocracy problem in the Democratic Party, and we're, you know, it is not an exaggeration, as the piece you quoted says, that if we did not lose these three House members, this disastrous bill might have been stopped. And it's also, you know, beyond the demographics, there's also just a basic, you know, failure of standing up for principle. You know, there was a earlier budget showdown that could have produced a government shutdown, and Democrats had leverage at that point to get concessions from Republicans in exchange for letting the budget go forward. And Chuck Schumer just folded like a cheap suit in the Senate and gave the Republicans everything that they demanded. That's the sort of longer term background to this disastrous bill that passed yesterday. The Republicans know they can count on Democrats either to, you know, to put things bluntly, to die or to fold. And, you know, this is a real problem.
I just want to note Heather Cox Richardson in her newsletter points out that we're talking about the single biggest increase in funding to immigration enforcement in the history of the United States, increasing ICE's detention budget from $3.4 billion a year to $45 billion through September 2029, a staggering 365% increase on an annual basis that would permit ICE to detain at least 100,000 people at a time. Your final comment, Chris Layman, as we move on to talk about one of the people who's in that detention system, Mahmoud Khalil.
Well, I think it's, again, important to outline in this case that this boondoggle to the repressive and, you know, illegal ICE detention system comes on the back of another Democratic capitulation. The same Democratic Senate voted to endorse the Laken Riley Act, which erected this new system of detention and rendition that's operating illegally and without accountability in our country. Prior to that, the Democrats eagerly touted Republican immigration reform that included many of these same draconian provisions. So, again, it's a failure of effective resistance and moral leadership on the part of the Democrats. And, yeah, it's a disastrous amping up of this shadow, fascist state.
And just to put an underscore on it, Heather Cox Richardson writes, it increases ICE budget for transportation and removal operations by 500% from the current $721 million to $14.4 billion. Also calls for more than $46 billion for construction barriers at the border, including completing 701 miles of wall, 900 miles of river barriers, 629 miles of secondary barriers, replacement of 141 miles of vehicle and pedestrian barriers. It calls for $45 billion for adult and family detention, enough to detain at least 100,000 people at a time. Chris Layman, I want to thank you for being with us, D.C. Bureau Chief for The Nation. We'll link to your piece, Trump and Johnson's Big Ugly Lie. When we come back, the jailed Palestinian activists who should have been walking across the graduation stage at Columbia this week, instead jailed in Jena, Louisiana. Mahmoud Khalil testified at his asylum hearing Thursday that if he is deported, it could result in assassination, kidnapping, torture. Hours before the hearing, Mahmoud Khalil got to hold his one-month-old baby, Dean, for the first time in Dean's little life. We'll get an update from Mahmoud Khalil's lawyer, Ramzi Qasem. Back in 20 seconds. Amel Mathlouthi, Tunisian singer, performing on Sunday night at the People's Graduation for Columbia Students, held in a church near the campus in honor of the Palestinian activist Mahmoud Khalil. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We turn now to an update on the case of Mahmoud Khalil, the jailed Palestinian activist and Columbia University graduate abducted by ICE in March, testified in his asylum hearing Thursday in Louisiana that he faces possible assassination, kidnapping, torture if he were to be deported after being, quote, mislabeled a terrorist sympathizer by the U.S. government. This is truly unlawful, what is happening to me, he said. I believe that justice will prevail. Those the words of Mahmoud Khalil as he fights for his release from an ICE prison thousands of miles away from his wife, Dr. Noor Abdallah, and their newborn baby, Dean. Hours before the hearing, Mahmoud was allowed to hold his one-month-old son and his wife for the first time. The emotional moment came after a federal judge blocked the Trump administration's efforts to keep Mahmoud behind a plexiglass barrier during the visit. Meanwhile, protesters traveled from across the country to Jena, Louisiana, for an action Thursday outside the ICE jail where Mahmoud has been held for over 2 months. This is the Palestinian-American organizer, Rhiannon Hammam.
That's why we're here, to show support for Mahmoud Khalil and show that the movement for a free Palestine, the movement to end genocide, to demand an arms embargo, we will not stop. Repeat after me. We will not stop.
We will not stop.
This facility, this ICE dungeon, has the capacity to hold more than 1,000 people. In everything that Mahmoud has written since his detention, he has drawn attention not just to himself, but the hundreds of other people in these cages with him. And so today, when we are rallying, when we are chanting, I want you to keep in mind that we want everyone in there to hear us, to know we are here for them.
Among the banners that the hundreds of protesters outside the Jena jail held was one that said fighting fascism is a Jewish value. Mahmoud Khalil was detained in March by federal immigration agents who illegally entered his private Columbia-owned apartment building here in New York City without a warrant. For more, we're joined by Ramzi Kassem, who's part of the legal team representing Mahmoud, professor of law at City University of New York, CUNY, where he founded and co-directs CLEAR, a legal clinic. The acronym stands for Creating Law Enforcement Accountability and Responsibility. Ramzi, welcome back to Democracy Now! It was an emotional day yesterday in Jena, Louisiana. Can you describe what happened? First at 7 to 8 in the morning, and then describe the immigration hearing that Mahmoud testified at personally.
Thank you for having me again, Amy. As your segment noted, Mahmoud and Dr. Abdullah and Baby Dean had their first opportunity since Dean's birth to be all together in one place. And it's really unfortunate that this administration forced us to go and get a federal court order to make that most basic human moment possible. You have to recall that Mr. Khalil is in immigration detention. That's supposed to be civil detention. It's supposed to be non-punitive. And I don't say this as a defense of what happens in criminal detention. But setting that aside, in a civil detention, non-punitive setting, the fact that the government was insisting on a no-contact visit was nothing short of cruel. And it's really unfortunate that we had to go get a court order for this legal meeting to happen in a way where Dr. Abdullah could discuss and meet with Mr. Khalil and with their baby in a way where they could hold each other for the first time since Mahmoud's unconstitutional detention. So that's how the day began. Then the immigration hearing proceeded. I want to highlight something that Mahmoud said because it's really centrally important to how we look at all of this. Mahmoud, near the beginning of the hearing, said that he did not expect any due process from these immigration proceedings, and that's for a very simple reason. That is not a real court. The judge, the immigration judge, is a DOJ, Department of Justice functionary who serves at the pleasure of the president, who is subject to government pressures, who can be fired at any time by the president, unlike an independent federal court judge. And what we've seen in the immigration court proceedings confirms Mahmoud's instinct and his statements, because we've seen a rush to judgment that I've never seen before in over 20 years of practice in immigration court. And it's essentially an attempt to accelerate that case in a court that the government controls in front of a judge that answers to the president in order to railroad Mahmoud Khalil and find him deportable. Testimony was taken. The judge denied our motion for additional time to respond to the government's evidence. The judge denied our motion to terminate, to dismiss the immigration court proceedings because of Mahmoud's unlawful arrest. We now have an admission from the government that there was no warrant for the arrest. And we also have video confirming that the government lied when it said that Mahmoud tried to run away, which is why they arrested him. And so we sought to terminate the case. The judge denied that. And we expect now, after filing written closings on June 2nd, the immigration judge indicated that she was going to rule both on his removability and on his claims for relief, including asylum.
What do you know about Judge Jamie Comins?
Not much. I haven't practiced in Louisiana personally, but what I can tell you about this immigration judge, again, is true for all immigration judges. They serve at the pleasure of the president, and this is a president who has not been shy about firing immigration judges, both at the trial level and at the Board of Immigration Appeals.
I want to ask you, we just had Mohsen Mahdawi in the studio in New York, and the reason I'm emphasizing this is because he was freed from the Vermont prison where he was held, also a Columbia student, a friend of Mahmoud's. He was freed by a Vermont judge. And when the federal government threatened to arrest him if he went over state lines to attend his graduation, The judge was extremely forceful in saying that he can not only come to New York, attend graduation, he can participate in protests, he can talk to media, he can talk to government officials, etc. So he got his diploma in person. Then there's the Fulbright scholar, the Tufts grad student, Rameysa Ozturk. She also has gotten out of detention. She was flown down to Louisiana, but a judge ordered her freedom. What is stopping a judge releasing the federal judges in New Jersey, Farbiars, having Mahmoud released? He already lost the opportunity to be with his wife, a dentist, Noor Abdullah, when she gave birth to their son. Now he just had this one-hour visit. What is stopping them from allowing him to come back here while he goes through these proceedings?
Well, Amy, myself and my organization, CLEAR, we also represent, as you know, Ms. Ozturk and Mr. Mahdawi. And we're very grateful for the orders that you've mentioned by Judge Sessions in Ms. Ozturk's case and Judge Crawford in Mr. Mahdawi's case out of the district court in Vermont. And we respect their process and their decisions just as much as we respect Judge Farbiars's process in Mr. Khalil's case in federal court in New Jersey. The federal court in New Jersey has been actively engaged in Mr. Khalil's case. It has issued a number of rulings, all, by the way, going in favor of Mr. Khalil and against the government's arguments about venue and jurisdiction and the like. We have a number of motions pending before the federal court in New Jersey, a motion to release Mr. Khalil on bail, a motion to compel the government to bring him back from Louisiana to New Jersey, and of course, a preliminary injunction that would set aside his detention. The judge is going through his process. We respect that process. We look forward to rulings on those motions, and we stand ready to provide the court with any additional information it might need or to argue any of these motions, as we were ready weeks ago to do. Every judge has their process. It's not for me to say what Judge Farbiars's process is, but he has been actively engaged, and we're looking forward to his rulings, because, again, we have no reason to expect and every reason not to expect due process out of the immigration courts.
What did Langston Hughes say? Justice delayed is justice denied, when you think of the landmarks in life that Mahmoud has already missed, like the birth of his son. But I wanted to ask you one more question, Ramzi. The Trump administration Thursday barred Harvard University from enrolling all international students by revoking its student exchange and visitor program certification. The news sent shockwaves way beyond Harvard, with legal experts warning the move is likely illegal. Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem sent the email, cited anti-Semitism for the move, an accusation the Trump administration's also wielded against other universities when withdrawing federal funds. She also accused Harvard of, quote, coordinating with the Chinese Communist Party. In April, Harvard refused to abide by Trump's list of demands related to DEI and free speech. Harvard also challenged a Trump order, a Trump administration order, to hand over the records of its current international students. Over a quarter of Harvard's student body is international. Unless the courts block the Trump administration move, even current students at Harvard will have to transfer out of the university or lose their visas. The significance of this?
Well, you know, this is part of the Trump administration's ongoing flirtation with authoritarianism. Part of the authoritarian playbook is to go after the institutions in a society that are most likely to be centers of opposition to authoritarian policies and practices. Universities are among those. We've seen the attack on the legal sector, on the nonprofit sector, on activists, outspoken activists like Mr. Khalil. And so as far as universities go, stripping Harvard of its certification to enroll foreign students now and in the future takes away a big part of its income. A quarter of its students are foreign students. They tend to pay a larger share of tuition than U.S. Students. And of course, you know, taking away federal funding from universities like Harvard and Columbia is another dimension of this effort to undermine universities as potential sites of resistance. But the thing I'd like to highlight is that had universities and the Biden administration taken a different tack over the last 2 years, the political space for these radical measures by the Trump administration would not have been opened up. In other words, It is precisely because a number of universities, including Harvard and Columbia and others, and precisely because the Biden administration spent so much time calling their own students terrorists because they were speaking up in defense of Palestinian lives and rights and against the genocide, criminalizing them. That's what opened up the space for the Trump administration to then come in and abduct Mahmoud Khalil and take these radical measures to undercut universities like Harvard and Columbia.
Ramsey, we just got this breaking news that Harvard University has sued the Trump administration over the move to bar all international students from attending Harvard. I want to thank you so much for being with us. Ramsey Kassam, part of the legal team representing Mahmoud Khalil. He's a professor of law at City University of New York, CUNY. To see our interviews with Mohsen Mahdawi here in studio, and then just after he walked across the Columbia stage to receive his degree, go to democracynow.org. When we come back, this Sunday marks 5 years since police murdered George Floyd. Stay with us.
Let me take you down, 'cause I'm going to Strawberry Fields. Nothing is real and nothing to get hung about. Strawberry Fields forever. Living is easy with eyes closed. Misunderstanding all we see. It's getting hard to be someone, but it all works out. It doesn't matter much to me. Déjame llevarte hacia donde voy. Strawberry Fields.
Strawberry Fields Forever by La Santa Cecilia, performing here in our Democracy Now! Studio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. This Sunday marks 5 years since George Floyd, an African-American man, was murdered by former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin, who was white. In a video that shocked the world, spurred a global movement for racial justice, Chauvin pinned George Floyd to the ground with a knee on his neck for 8 minutes while George Floyd gasped for air. In a video that's now been seen around the world, he repeatedly said, "I can't breathe." The warning, the video is extremely graphic.
I cannot breathe.
You're just a grown, you're a tough guy. You're a tough guy. He's not even resisting arrest, bro.
His whole nose is
a fall with him.
Bro, why you just sitting there? He ain't doing nothing now. Put him in the car.
It'll kill me.
Three other officers stood with Derek Chauvin, one of them holding back those who wanted to help George Floyd. In the days that followed, thousands took to the streets of Minneapolis, and demonstrators set fire to a police precinct just hours after prosecutors said they were not yet sure if they would criminally charge Chauvin for murdering George Floyd, as seen in the video. Even as police fired tear gas and rubber-coated bullets at demonstrators, the protests spread to become the largest nationwide uprising since the 60s as protesters shut down cities across the United States.
George Floyd! George Floyd! George Floyd! George Floyd!
Despite the uprising that followed George Floyd's killing, Congress failed to pass the legislation named in Floyd's memory that sought to reduce racial profiling and the use of force by law enforcement. This comes as the Justice Department this week dismissed police reform and oversight agreements in Minneapolis and Louisville, or just days ahead of the fifth anniversary of the police murder of George Floyd. The consent decrees came in response to Floyd's murder, as well as the Louisville police killing of Breonna Taylor, March 13, 2020, after federal investigations found patterns of unconstitutional and racist police practicing in both cities. The Trump administration disputed those findings and dismissed the consent decrees as federal micromanagement. For more, we're joined in Minneapolis by Nkema Levy Armstrong, civil rights attorney, activist, founder of the Racial Justice Network, previously served as president of the Minneapolis NAACP. Nkema, welcome back to Democracy Now! We first spoke to you in 2020, 2 days after George Floyd's murder. Can you talk about the significance of this moment and what we can learn from what happened at the time? First, the charges not being brought, then it being taken out of the hands of the local authorities, and the state of Minnesota brought those charges.
Thank you for having me, Amy. We can learn from that moment that people in our community are not going to sit on the sidelines when folks in elected positions take their time in bringing about justice. As you know, there was an uprising that occurred in the city of Minneapolis as people applied pressure to elected officials to do their jobs and to ensure accountability, not only for Derek Chauvin, but the other three officers as well who were involved in the brutal killing of George Floyd.
Explain what the protests did. You know, we talked about the local authorities saying they weren't sure if they were going to bring charges. And then you had Keith Ellison, the attorney general of the state of Minnesota, who had formerly been a Congress member, and the governor, talk about how the responsibility then shifted and the charges were brought. And what happened to these four police officers?
Thank you for that question. I will say that it's important for people to understand that even when there is a video of heinous police abuse, that does not guarantee that justice will occur, as we just saw with Tyre Nichols and the way in which that particular case has panned out. So in the city of Minneapolis, one of the first steps was ensuring that all four officers were fired for their misconduct. And that was the result of Chief Madeira Arredondo, our city's first Black chief of police, making that decision within hours after George Floyd's murder came to light and meeting with Black community leaders to hear our perspectives before making that decision. Once that happened, of course, we had the first protest plan where thousands of people showed up at the site where George Floyd was killed. We marched to the 3rd Precinct police station where the officers had typically worked who were responsible for killing George Floyd. And then from that point, we started a rallying cry for those officers to be charged and arrested for what they did. Now, the governmental officials were slow to respond initially. And after some public pressure, the county attorney at the time, Mike Freeman, decided to only charge Derek Chauvin. The charges were legally insufficient. They were below the standard, as well as the criminal complaint against Derek Chauvin. So when I saw that, I reached out to movement lawyers through the National Lawyers Guild. I expressed my concerns about the process. They agreed with me. So we called a mass demonstration along with other activist organizations like Black Lives Matter. And we had thousands of people in front of the governor's mansion explaining to people how the charging decision by the county attorney was inadequate. And Governor Walz actually came out of his mansion. He listened to us break down what the concerns were, how things needed to change. And after that, I received a call from his staff to meet with him directly. So he and I had a Zoom call. During that call, I laid out more of the legal issues, as well as the fact that he needed to use his executive authority to remove the case from the hands of the county attorney and to put the case into the hands of the attorney general. And Amy, you and the rest of the world saw the results of that trial during the prosecution of Derek Chauvin, which was a masterclass on how to effectively and successfully prosecute a cop who used deadly force unjustifiably. once the case was in the hands of the Attorney General's office, the other thing that happened is that not only was Derek Chauvin charged, but all four of the officers were charged as well. And the charges for Derek Chauvin were also upgraded. And as you know, ultimately, all four of those officers were convicted in state and federal court as a result of the murder of George Floyd.
In 30 seconds, can you tell us about Trump lifting the consent decrees off of the Minneapolis Police Department, Louisville, Breonna Taylor, the significance of this?
It is very clear that Donald Trump's intention is to roll back the progress that began, I would say, in 2020 and even before that, when the folks in Ferguson, Missouri rose up after Mike Brown was killed. It is a slap in the face to the Black community and communities around the country for Trump's DOJ to withdraw from the consent decree process. It's unconscionable. It's unacceptable. And I would argue that it is an attempt to create a race war, wanting us to take to the streets so that Donald Trump can use martial law against protesters. But we're not falling for the bait. We are continuing to call out these injustices and to say that we are expecting accountability. We're expecting reform and transformation of police departments that engage in unconstitutional policing practices.
Nikki, we just have another 30 seconds. And my question to you is, the police murder of George Floyd happened during the first term of President Trump. To say the least, he's been openly hostile to the Black Lives Movement. In 2020, he reportedly ordered the military to, quote, beat the F out of BLM protesters, even shoot them. Where does the movement go from here as you mark it in Minneapolis this weekend?
I think that the movement has to continue to grow stronger. We have to resist the pressure that is coming from the White House to be silent and to feel as if the concerns that we're bringing don't hold merit. We know that is not the truth. We know that racial injustice in America is still alive and well. We know that police brutality continues to occur at alarming rates, and we have to continue to use our voices and stand up against Donald Trump and stand up against these systems of oppression, regardless of the pressure that he is attempting to apply in this hour. This moment calls for us to rise up and continue to take a stand for freedom, justice, and equality in this country, and especially for those who are most vulnerable to police violence and oppression.
Nikema Levy-Armstrong, I want to thank you so much for being with us from Minneapolis, civil rights attorney, activist, founder of the Racial Justice Network. As we mark the fifth anniversary of the police murder of George Floyd in Minneapolis, what the New York Times called one of America's most liberal cities, we end today's show with a new book that reexamines the experience of the civil rights leader, Dr. Martin Luther King, with police brutality and his sustained critique of police brutality in the North as well as the South. Jean Theo Harris is a historian and professor of political science at Brooklyn College, author of 13 books about the civil rights movement, the fight for racial justice. Her new book is King of the North, Martin Luther King Jr.'s Life of Struggle Outside the South. Welcome back to Democracy Now! Can you start off with another viral moment, an image of police brutality that you describe in your book? I watched you talk about it last night at the Brooklyn Public Library. The photo of Reverend Martin Luther King being arrested in 1958.
So, Dr. King, thank you for having me back. It's so great to be here. So this is 1958. Dr. King and Coretta Scott King have gone to see Ralph Abernathy in court. The court doesn't want him there. The police then start to harass him at the courthouse and then decide they're going to arrest him. They push her away. She's objecting. And they basically march him down the street. But there happens to be a photographer. And so as they're marching him down the street and into the police station, this photographer's taking pictures. And what they do when they get to the police station is they half Nelson him, as we see in this photo, onto the counter. They're like grabbing his arm and twisting it. You can tell he's in pain. And then once they get out of sight, because as you might imagine, they're mad. The police are mad that Dr. King, that somebody's been taking this picture. So once they get him in the cell, they kick him, they choke him, they try to break his arm. But this photo goes in the terms of 1958. It goes out over the news wires. And it may be the first, it's certainly one of the first images of police brutality that make it into the mainstream news. Most mainstream news organizations did not cover police brutality. So this image is outrageous and it's outraging. And 2 weeks later, he comes to Harlem and he's doing a nighttime rally on 125th Street, right down from Malcolm X's Speaker Corner, right down from where Johnson Hinton had been brutalized by police. And Dr. King talks about...
This is what year?
This is 2 weeks after. Uh-huh. This is 1958. And he's there with thousands of New Yorkers, and he's talking about his own experience with police brutality, and Harlemites are angry, and they see themselves in him. And I think we often miss this as a key issue throughout the civil rights movement. We often put it in the South when Dr. King and many others are calling attention and protesting this across the country.
He said he was more scared in Chicago than he'd ever been in the South. But you talk about in 1964 in Harlem also, right. King decrying the police killing of an unarmed teenager,
yep.
was sued by the New York police officer who killed the young man. And there was a march there that actually dwarfed the March on Washington in 63?
Right. There's huge marches that... What you're referring to is he calls for this officer, Thomas Gilligan. He calls the what he does a murder, just like you were just doing about George Floyd, the police murder.
Well, and he was convicted.
And the cop sues him for damage to his reputation. And one of the, you know, and all the newspapers then let the cop launder his reputation. So King comes to New York. Mayor Wagner invites King, thinking King is going to maybe help quiet down these protests. They're massive protests for days. And instead, King, in a series of meetings with the mayor, says you need to fire the cop. You need to have real civilian like complaint review board. You need to have a jobs program. You need to desegregate. Mayor Wagner rejects it all. And basically, King is like almost run out of town for the notion that he's calling for a kind of real civilian oversight of the police. And this is 1964 here, right here in New York City.
Professor Theo Harris, we just have a minute, and we're going to do a post show and post it at democracynow.org to talk about the revelations in this book. How could we be talking about revelations about Dr. King? Because he's been written about so thoroughly, yet it's this radical history, especially around police killings of black men and women, that you say has really not been thoroughly documented.
I mean, I think we've southernized Dr. King. And so his critique of police brutality outside the South, his longstanding critique of school segregation, of housing segregation, of job discrimination, King sees these as national, not local. But again, we've told a story where King is in the South till 1965, and somehow then, when Watts erupts, then he discovers the North. When, in fact, Dr. King had been in L.A. more than 15 times before the Watts uprising, had been protesting around police brutality for years, joined a movement in 1962 protesting the police killing of Nation of Islam Secretary Ron Stokes, had talked about, this is King, no compromise on this issue, in L.A. in 1962. In 1963, calling L.A. as segregated as Birmingham, even while he's engaged in the movement in Birmingham. But we tend to see that as a Southern story when King is talking about everywhere.
And that's why you titled the book King of the North. We're going to talk more about it at democracynow.org. Jean Theo Harris, historian, new book, King of the North, Martin Luther King Jr.'s Life of Struggle Outside the South. That does it for our show. Happy birthday to Mike DeFilippo. Coming up Memorial Day, our special, we speak to acclaimed filmmaker Ryan Coogler about his new film, Sinners, and to Keith Lamar on death row in Ohio. Look for our new job listings. We're hiring a senior headline news producer, a director of audience, director of technology. Go to democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
All aboard for the Sunshine Special. This train is headed for better times. All aboard.